The Guardian.
Around 4,500 years ago, a craze for bell-shaped pottery beakers spread across what is now Europe. Archaeologists have unearthed the distinctive pots at sites spanning from the Iberian Peninsula to Ireland in the west and Poland in the east. They appear in Britain at around the same time that Stonehenge was being built. The artefacts are linked to what is known as the bell beaker culture. But archaeologists are divided on whether the spread of the beakers identifies a Bronze Age fashion that was passed from one settlement to another, like prehistoric fidget spinners, or whether there was a mass migration of beaker folk. This is a question that has been impossible to answer by studying the artefacts alone. But now, a major ancient genome study is helping to resolve this mystery. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly. To discuss beaker folk and ancient DNA, I'm joined by Ben Roberts, an archaeologist at the University of Durham. So Ben, there's been a major new study of ancient genomes linked to the beaker sites that's just been published on the website BioArchive, and it comes from the group of David Reich at Harvard Medical School. Could you just tell me a bit about how this study is changing this picture?
The paper presents ancient DNA genomes from 170 individuals, not only from Britain, but also from Western Europe, spanning from the Neolithic farmers through the Copper Age and the Bronze Age. And the idea is to look at issues of changes or continuity in that ancient DNA. And what they find is that the Neolithic farmers in Britain are actually pretty similar in terms of the ancient DNA to populations at the same time in continental Europe. They also find, perhaps most spectacularly, that there is a very significant change in the ancient DNA when you start to compare those early farmers with the ancient DNA from beaker burials, and especially those in Britain. The ones in Britain, what they're seeing is that all the individuals they looked at had high proportions of ancient DNA that relate them to steppe populations. So populations who were living in Eastern Europe and beyond, into the steppe, into the Caucasus region. And these are individuals that have been identified from the ancient DNA across continental Europe and are strongly thought to have been moving from the Eastern European and steppe areas throughout Europe during this time between 5,000 years ago and 4,000 years ago.
So Ben, would that be consistent then with a population that was moving through Europe and as they moved through, local groups were adopting some of their culture, but in Britain, they were replacing existing populations?
Based on the samples that they have from Britain, it does look like that, but they only have 19 individuals and we're talking about hundreds of beaker burials. So the really interesting thing is when you compare the ancient DNA signature from burials that have been looked at from individuals in Iberia and Spain and Portugal with Britain, you have in Spain and Portugal, the ancient DNA signature is very varied. And sometimes it looks like it's got a kind of classic indications of the population from the Eurasian steppe. And in other cases, not. In Britain, they all have a high proportion of ancient DNA that relates them to the Eurasian steppe populations.
Ben, could you just tell me a bit about what was going on in ancient Britain at that time, and if it was a migration, what the beaker folk might have encountered?
So in Britain, about 4,500 years ago, what we have is a long established tradition of massive monument building. And so the most iconic things that we would see around this time are huge monuments, Stonehenge being the classic example, reasons that we're not entirely clear about, to be honest. We know certainly what their temples, if you like, what their ritual centers look like, and we can tell you a bit about what they did at those ritual centers. For instance, you had feasting famously at several sites, but we don't have many houses. So whilst there have been some settlements discovered near Stonehenge, for the vast majority of the time during sort of 2500 BC and the several hundred years after that, we probably have maybe 150, 200 settlements maximum. So what they would have encountered would have been quite a different world to the one that they came from.
And was Stonehenge still being built during this time period? And could the job of building it have been taken over by newcomers?
No, the job of building Stonehenge was certainly well underway by this time. Essentially, you've got your first major phase at Stonehenge about 3000 or so BC. There's no indication that the beaker burials were closely related to Stonehenge. Even the most opulent, fantastic beaker burial, the Amesbury Archer, is actually quite a few kilometres away from Stonehenge. So whilst you have one beaker burial within the Stonehenge complex and you've got some burials around it, there's no indication of a close affiliation between the two.
Let's take a break to hear an advert which keeps these podcasts free. Just before we go on to the ancient DNA, can you tell me a bit about what the isotope approach has told us? Is that linked to the nutrition that the people would have been having, the water?
The strontium and oxygen isotopes, as well as others as well, this is a whole field of which, in terms of the research on beaker burials, my colleague in Durham, Dr. Janet Montgomery, is the leader on. This allows you to identify dietary patterns and more specifically the prevalence of marine dietary patterns versus terrestrial food dietary patterns. And it would also allow you to give some indication of mobility, but it has to be related to that individual moving from one place when they were younger to another place where they were eventually died later in life.
So for that, you'd really need to capture that specific moment when a particular group was moving from one place to another.
Yep. So it would be very much focused on a first generation, for instance. If you're talking about a population that moved from one region to another region, then you would get the first generation should have some indications and the second generation wouldn't, as long as they stayed in one place. Now, the nice thing is that there's been a massive study on this, the Beaker People Project, led by Professor Mike Parker-Pearson at UCL, with the isotopes done by Dr. Janet Montgomery in Durham. And they've just published their results, and the results indicated on a very substantial sample of 264 individuals, many of whom are beaker burials, that you've got mobility within Britain, especially from childhood to adulthood, but very, very little mobility from continental Europe to Britain. And so I think the expectation of many of us was that we'd see more mobility from continental Europe to Britain. Whether you're kind of really a believer in broader migration and mobility theories or not. And so this was a bit of a surprise. And so that was published just last year. And then this ancient DNA paper that has just been published now, led by the Harvard team, actually then highlights quite a different interpretation based on the ancient DNA, where you've got a more explicit migration and indeed population replacement model.
Now, like you said, this is a fairly small data set. To what extent can we extrapolate and say that the existing population was wiped out or, you know, pushed to the fringes?
One of the most important things from this paper is that it does indicate a very strong ancient DNA signature in the beaker populations that they've analysed, and that this ancient DNA signature is different from the earlier Neolithic farming populations. Now, the big question is, how representative are these burials of what comes along at the time and what comes later in terms of the people? We don't know that. But the really exciting thing is that the idea of population replacement as a model for explaining the beaker burials and the beaker package is something that hasn't really been considered, at least in British archaeology, since the 1960s. And it was almost considered for many decades just something that was not something you can evidence archaeologically. So that's now back on the table. So I can't tell you how representative this is going to be when we have many more ancient DNA studies. But this is a fantastically important finding, because previously there'd been a widespread acceptance that Neolithic farmers had brought in a new population in terms of their ancient DNA, but not that this later beaker burial population had actually represented something different.
Is this question something that we can resolve by looking at other burial sites more recently in the record and maybe even looking at modern population DNA?
The challenge that you have with the ancient populations is that cremation becomes increasingly dominant as the funerary rite. So essentially, by about 2000 BC, so just 500 years after your earliest evidence for beaker objects or beaker burials in Britain, you've got a parity between people being buried and people actually being cremated. And then just a few hundred years after that, by about 1600 BC, almost all the evidence for the dead we have is cremation. And it continues like that for well over 1,000 years. And then it becomes very regional indeed as to whether you're finding intact burials or whether you're finding cremation burials. So it's very, very hard from the ancient DNA to actually say, oh, well, we've got a completely representative population, especially because the majority of that population after the beaker burials are being cremated. So it's going to be very hard to actually say if this population replacement occurred and was long-lasting.
What about modern populations? I mean, you kind of think of the people who built Stonehenge as being, you know, the ancestors of people who live in Britain today, but perhaps that's not the case.
Whilst I'm not a geneticist, I've followed the debates quite closely, and the challenge that you've had is that a lot of the earlier studies prior to ancient DNA extraction technologies becoming more widespread used the genetics of modern populations, and they came to conclusions that were then subsequently challenged by ancient DNA analysis. So you could reach a conclusion that says, right, we have this genetic signature in the modern population, and we think this occurred 4,000 years ago. But you don't know that occurred 4,000 years ago because there's no way that you can independently verify the timescale of genetic change. So you can assume that there's a sort of regular molecular clock, if you will, but you definitely don't know that. So the challenge you have with working with modern populations is that you may find all sorts of patterns, and you're pretty sure that some of those genetic patterns have quite a deep time depth. And you can make an argument there, but you don't know how deep that time depth is. Whereas with ancient DNA, you're actually analyzing the original populations in the deep past, so you can say with some certainty. The challenge is that at the moment, we're only dealing with small samples, so we've only got 19 individuals on this paper who are from Britain as beaker burials. But in the future, we'll have many, many more ancient DNA analyses. And this is where it will start to get interesting, because I think we'll start to see much more variation. And it's always the case with the new scientific technique in archaeology. The early results provide a very sort of simple, straightforward story that makes perfect sense to the scientists who are actually conducting the study. And then you go 5 to 10 years on, and there's been all sorts of new sites and new individuals who've been analyzed, and suddenly it looks a lot messier, and frequently ends up conforming to broadly what was understood beforehand.
Is this kind of ancient DNA analysis having a big impact in archaeology and maybe challenging archaeologists to become, you know, more scientific than ever before in the way they interpret their results?
I think it's ancient DNA analysis is certainly having a massive impact on archaeology. It is without doubt the most exciting scientific development within archaeology at the moment. No question about that. And there's been some fantastic work being done that has challenged archaeological interpretations in many ways. Where we're at now is a point where we're getting some very substantial population studies being done of ancient populations. And I think we can start to see more evaluation of the ancient DNA interpretations against models developed from archaeology or developed from isotope studies or other forms of scientific analysis. Because what we haven't had yet is that proper evaluation of one model against another model. If an ancient DNA scientist or project is leading the project, then they will largely write the interpretation of the data. If an archaeologist is leading it, they will write it. If an isotope scientist is writing, they will lead it. And whilst this paper has got a lot of excellent top archaeologists on it, I would say that whilst they've made some good points on it, very few of those archaeologists will start subscribing to the 90% population replacement model that's being put forward. I think they would be much more cautious.
Are there archaeologists who find it a bit annoying in some ways that these ancient DNA specialists are sort of coming in and completely rewriting the history book based on, you know, one or two studies?
I think archaeologists, prehistoric archaeologists especially, are very used to being wrong. Any theory that people come, that a prehistoric archaeologist comes up with, is usually challenged within 5 to 10 years and maybe completely refuted within their lifetime. It's just the nature of the discipline. There'll be a new discovery, a new scientific technique, and it may well prove that not only you were wrong, but someone writing about 100 years ago, based on hardly any data at all, was actually completely right. So we are certainly getting closer to understanding many, many aspects of the past, but the nature of prehistoric archaeology is that we're quite used to scientific techniques and new discoveries disproving theories. But what we are also used to is that as that scientific technique develops within archaeology and more samples are done, more data is generated, that initial very simple story of a mass migration or a population replacement at 90% is usually then evolving into something that's much, much more complex and not nearly as straightforward. So I think archaeologists take this in their stride.
Are there any other really big open questions in archaeology that this kind of analysis might be on the brink of solving?
I think there's endless amounts of new questions that ancient DNA can address with regards to the relationships between ancient populations. And this can be as small as models of kinship within groups, but also much more substantially within issues of movement of populations and potential migrations. I think it's not going to be able to do everything, because if a population is deciding to cremate all of its dead, then you're not going to get any ancient DNA at all. So for populations that I study, for instance, in some of my projects from 3,500 years ago to 2,500 years ago in Britain, ancient DNA is virtually irrelevant because there's hardly any bodies for them to analyze. So I think it's having a huge impact, for instance, on Paleolithic Stone Age archaeology, and it will continue to have a huge impact on the rest of prehistory and history. I think it's a really exciting time, but I think what you're getting are these big papers that come out with huge regularity that are opening debates, but definitely not closing them as yet.
If you've enjoyed this episode, you can review it and be in with a chance of featuring in our weekly podcast column, Hear Hear. Just email podcasts@theguardian.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, so get involved. We want to hear from you. Science Weekly was presented by me, Hannah Devlin, and produced by Gabriella Jones. We'll be back next week.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.